watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Bush wants $245 billion for war, a war that the majority of the American people want ended, the majority of the military likewise. The justifications given for the war have been revealed as lies, and it is a war crime. But the Congress, except for a few stalwart souls, won't cut the funds nor pursue impeachment, though they have a mandate for all of this. What is going on? This week, we follow the money. The January Harper's Magazine published an article by Chalmers Johnson. It was based on his new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, that will be released this week. We'll begin the program with a conversation Johnson had with KZYX's Jeff Blankford mid-January.
Chalmers Johnson taught from 1962 to 1992 at the Berkeley and San Diego campuses of the University of California and held endowed chairs in Asian politics at both. At Berkeley, he chaired the Center for Chinese Studies and the Department of Political Science. From 1968 until 1972, he served as a consultant to the Office of National Estimates of the Central Intelligence Agency. He's written some 16 books, from Peasant Nationalism and Communist Power in the Chinese Revolution to, more recently, in the post-9/11 era, the award-winning Blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire in 2000, and The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic in 2004. His new book, Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, will be published by Metropolitan, and that, together with an article on the same topic in the January issue of Harper's, is what we'll be discussing. Welcome, Chalmers Johnson. The title of your article in the current Harper's, Republic or Empire, suggests that a country with the power of the United States must inevitably make a choice as to which of the two it plans to be, and the content of the article gives convincing evidence that it has chosen the path empire to its detriment and eventual denouement, and that choice has never been more exemplified than by the current resident of the White House, who by coincidence is speaking tonight. I assume you're anticipating yet further proof of your argument.
Well, yes, I am. I think it's a false choice that we've got. We've been using the wrong means, even on the president's terms, in Iraq and in the Middle East. He continues to avoid the main issues, a few of which were identified by the Iraq Study Group that the Congress appointed. This is not going to go anywhere. Military force is the wrong thing. We know about escalation from Vietnam. But it looks like we're going to do it again. That's the reason why the subtitle of my new book is The Last Days of the American Republic. It becomes more apparent all the time that we are unable to alter course.
Well, in your article, you use a term that has become, how to describe the American empire, the situation today, military Keynesianism, and many of our older listeners at least have heard references to the economist John Maynard Keynes over the years.
Yes.
Without knowing that much about him, who was he and what is meant by Keynesianism?
Well, John Maynard Keynes was a very prominent English economist who at the time of the Great Depression in the 1930s wrote a famous book advocating so-called counter-cyclical priming by the government. This meant that in the face of such huge unemployment, the government should make work to find jobs for people one way or another. Some of it may have been indeed simply that, make work. He once spoke of burying money in unused mine shafts and then paying people to dig it up again. Some of these ideas informed the New Deal. By military Keynesianism, what we're referring to is the use, instead of make work, or above all, counter-cyclical. That is to say, the Keynes' idea was that in periods of high unemployment, the government would put money in people's pockets in order to revive consumption in the economy. But that when there was more or less full employment, then you would cut back this governmental pump priming and try to balance the budget and produce some savings. This never worked perfectly. Conservatives were always extremely skeptical that this would give too much power to the working class, to unions and things of this sort. The way it actually did turn out during World War II was military Keynesianism, in which the government stimulates the economy enormously by weapons manufacturing, by going to war, and things of this sort. One of the things that I discuss in the article in Harper's Magazine, as well as in my new book, is the degree to which, as a consequence of our militarism, the American economy has become seriously distorted today by military Keynesianism. We try to cover it up by thinking of it as free enterprise, but there's nothing. There's no free enterprise at all in operations with the Pentagon. It's one customer and a very select series of weapons manufacturers that are favored. What we're, in another sense, we're talking about the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned us against in his farewell address in 1961. Today, it is remarkable the degree to which our country manufactures less and less every day and is quite and often rather uncompetitive in areas that it does manufacture. But except for one major area, we are easily the world's largest arms manufacturer, and we sell these arms to anybody who can put up the money.
Would that also make sure there'd be some other wars going, which will require the use of the U.S. military?
Well, that's one of the things that it does. It leads to virtually perpetual war and a cycle of wars. There's a feedback loop here. And, of course, again, in Keynes's terms of pump priming, you never come to a point where you you go counter-cyclical. Once you get down this path, you can't let it go. One of the best signs we see of this in America is when every 3 or 4 years, the Secretary of Defense, in accordance with law, comes out with a list of domestic military bases he'd like to close because they're no longer needed or wanted. This invariably produces an outcry from every community that's going to lose a base, from members of Congress, businessmen, down to preachers and newspaper editorials about save our base, meaning save our jobs. It suggests how deeply military Keynesianism has penetrated into our society. And, of course, the arms manufacturers understand this. On a big project like, say, the B-2 bomber, they try to put a piece of it in as many different constituencies as they possibly can, so that if a member of Congress got the idea that we didn't need this new weapon of mass destruction, the Department of Defense could put a great many of his constituents out of work and presumably cause him to lose the next election. It's a cycle that builds on itself and would be very, very difficult today to reverse.
Well, it's interesting in this regard. Note there's essentially no debate in Congress over the amount of military spending, euphemistically described as defense spending.
But yes, exactly.
And the Republican Party is very open about its commitment to the big numbers. And the Democrats actually don't talk about it. They excuse their support for it by not wanting to appear weak on defense, as if the United States is about to be attacked.
Nobody's ever accused them of it, and we our defense, so-called defense, as you say, military spending right now is, by the United States, is equal to that of all the rest of the world. That moreover, these arms manufacturers, manufacturing, as I say, is not free enterprise in some sense, because this foreign military sales are run entirely by the Pentagon, not by the manufacturers. It's I think, a very serious problem, and hard to imagine, as I say, how it could be reversed.
And we know many of these sales are subsidized by U.S. taxpayers.
Oh, absolutely.
And particularly in the case of Israel, what it ends up is being the Israel main Israel lobby in Washington, AIPAC, is also a strong supporter of a big budget, a military budget.
No question about it. $3 billion a year is written right into the U.S. defense budget to go straight to Israel.
And consequently, the larger the defense military budget, the smaller percentage that $3 billion is.
Yes, precisely.
When you look at this situation, when you talk, the Democrats have come into power, it does not appear that there will be really any change. There may be a change in the speeches on the floor of the House, but we see people who are supposedly have opposed the war in Iraq from the beginning. We hear that Nancy Pelosi has, which is not true. But when it comes to opposing the war, Congress has basically only one step to take, and that is cutting off the funds, and she says that's not going to happen, as does Harry Reid.
Right. Well, that's the absurdity of it all. I mean, that's what finally led to the end of the Vietnam War, was the putting caps on the money that Nixon and company could continue to spend there. It's the power that defines the Congress. It is the mark of a true parliament that it has control of the funds. The failure to use this power is simply to abdicate responsibility and to continue with a sort of papering over of the failures of Congress. This is one of the failures of the United States, is that in our constitutional system, Congress was supposed to be the central agency, the main source of democratic representation in the government. It's failed disastrously. The imperial presidency is a very serious problem, no question about it, and the weird ambitions of Bush and his neoconservative supporters. But by the same token, the Congress has virtually failed its responsibilities. Now, we will see how this initiative introduced by Senator Kennedy from Massachusetts, saying that there will be no further sending of troops to Iraq without congressional approval, that has to be, first of all, passed by the Congress, and we'll see whether it can occur or not. But my own feeling in general terms is that, of course, the political system has failed us. It's hard for me to imagine any president of any party coming to power in the United States today and being able to bring under control the military-industrial complex or the 16 intelligence agencies that compete for power. The Central Intelligence Agency is essentially a private army of the president's today, and I mean private army with no, that is to say, everything they do is by law secret and has been since it was created in 1947. It's impossible to do oversight on that. 40% of the defense budget is black, that is not to be revealed to anybody except military officers, and so the system just, that is, we are back now to a failure of a very important part of Article 1 of the Constitution, that the public will ultimately know how their tax dollars were spent. That's not been true in the United States since the Manhattan Project, developing atom bombs during World War II.
My guest is Chalmers Johnson. One of the things with which very few Americans, I suspect, are aware are the billions of dollars of military-related items that are not included in the so-called defense budget, and you discuss that in your article. What are some of those big-ticket items?
Well, nuclear weapons, for example. They're in the Department of Energy. The huge and escalating costs for our wounded, one of the medical achievements of our time is that the way men are wounded in Iraq in the past, they almost surely would have died of their wounds. Today, we keep them alive, but it requires, in many cases, round-the-clock care for the rest of their lives. This is extremely expensive and is not properly funded. There are the costs that go through the Treasury Department of paying for our past wars, We are easily the most indebted nation on earth today, and the interest on that debt is huge. These are just some of the things that that go into it. And even the main so-called defense budget, namely the Pentagon budget, which is not really a defense budget. When we discovered we had a problem with national defense as a result of the 9/11 attacks, we created a new agency, the Department of Homeland Security, to try and deal with that problem. The Department of Defense is a euphemism that has almost nothing to do with defense and everything to do with imperialism. But again, the main defense budget is itself such a sort of Enron-like accounting that it's very hard to know precisely how much is there, how it's numerous ways in which it is disguised and broken down into little pieces. It's almost an impossible task today to try and account for it and to maintain oversight.
Well, I recall it was sometime during the 50s that the Defense Department came into being. It was previously called the War Department.
Exactly.
And then they started putting PR spins on the language. Like today we have something called the surge of troops. And immediately the media, like trained SEALs, starts talking about a surge in troops. It's an increase, an escalation of troops. And it's amazing. Once in a while, someone will make a comment about it, a joking comment about it. But by and large,
yes,
this word surge has now had a new meaning.
Well, this is another one of the failures of of our democratic system, the virtual inability of a citizen to play the citizen's role in the system, in the government, because of lack of information, which reflects the control of our media by conglomerates who are in business to make money selling advertising rather than informing the public. So that indeed words like surge are used, whereas it was escalation during the Vietnam War. But no one seems to really want to say, as escalation involves, it means take a failed strategy and simply do more of it, which is what I presume Bush will say this evening.
Well, it's interesting that I was not aware in the last election campaign in which the Democrats swept out the Republicans,
yes,
there is really any discussion at any level of what we've been talking about. There are, I believe, over 750 U.S. bases in 120 countries.
Yes.
This is never talked about.
Right. Well, that's one of the things I've been trying to do with this series of books on this issue. And again, when I use a subtitle for my new book, Nemesis, of the Last Days of the American Republic, I'm not trying to just be alarmist. I am trying to say, any historian would tell you, looking over the ages, that there's something hopelessly unstable about the combination of a domestic democracy and a foreign empire. That is, democratic government domestically, tyranny abroad, in the sense that empire never, ever rests on consent. It rests on exactly our position in Iraq. Come in with military force and push people out of the way, tell them what to do, just like the song you were playing at the beginning of your program. Historically, these things have usually been resolved in one way or the other. That is, a nation that has become an empire but is a domestic democracy, either one, like the Roman Republic, loses its democracy and becomes a military dictatorship, or it's not the most perfect case, but it's pretty close to it. Britain, after World War II, essentially gave up its global empire in order to maintain its democracy, meaning, above all, giving up India, the huge subcontinent of Asia that the British had run for a century and a half. These are the stark choices. I believe, unfortunately, we are tending in the Roman direction these days, as we see in the growth of the imperial presidency, the breakdown of the separation or balance of powers that was written into our Constitution in order to prevent tyranny. We see gathering evidence. I try to lay out a great deal of it in this new book of the concentration of power in the executive branch. Of course, the cause of this, imperialism as an inescapable accompaniment, produces militarism. And here we don't just have to go back to Eisenhower for warnings. This goes back to George Washington, who made it clear in his farewell address that the greatest enemy of the structure of government that he and others had just created, the greatest enemy would be standing armies, the attraction of power to Washington, D.C., vested interests in the standing armies. Militarism does not mean defense of the country. We all understand that there are circumstances under which citizens may have to defend the country against aggression. But militarism means a way of life, a way of making a living, huge vested interests that, as I say, Eisenhower famously warned us against. We don't need to overstate Eisenhower's achievements. I mean, he was also the butcher of Guatemala and quite a few other things. It was on his watch that militarism became uncontrolled. But he did warn in very stark terms that this was something new in our system, that we had to watch it, control it, beware of its consequences. We rather palpably, obviously, have not done so and are now faced with the distinct possibility that the system will collapse into some form of dictatorship.
Well, it's interesting. Today, our school kids all around the country learn about the three branches of government and the checks and balances. And I'm confident that there's really no discussion of how this is actually working today.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us what your opinion is of how the courts are performed?
Well, again, they're today deeply cowed by the pretensions of the president. These new inventions of his, sophistic lawyers, that as the authority to be commander-in-chief written in the Constitution basically makes him immune to any checks on this power. His most recent and absurd statement is that this gives him the power to open mail, which without a court warrant, that we already see it in numerous other forms of surveillance, which under Article 4 of the Constitution should require establishment in a court of probable cause that somebody has committed a crime and that it is proper for us to wiretap him or invade his home or something of that sort to gather evidence. These are elementary checks. It's hard to imagine our court system actually posing any real difficulties for a president who wants to exercise these powers of these police powers. But at the same time, Bush proceeds ahead with it, and we come up with a... I mean, it's hard to believe that today we're actually discussing in our country whether or not the president has the power to torture citizens, non-citizens that he captures, that he puts in a prison in an extremely anomalous place, namely the base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. And that Abu Ghraib is rarely mentioned anymore. I don't think the American public appreciates how utterly devastating this is to the reputation of the United States and the ideas for which it has stood.
Well, again, in this last election, I don't recall any national campaign or statement about the Democrats as part of their program is returning the civil rights that have been taken away by the Bush administration to the public.
Well, exactly. I mean, that is precisely the problem. One wonders, could you have some sort of a mobilization from below? That's what you were talking about earlier. It's certainly conceivable. One has the slightest hint of this in the air in the country today. The public is beginning ever so inchoately to understand what they are about to lose, and once it's lost, it will be lost. It won't be coming back. Just as the Romans began to understand what they lost when they went from the Roman Republic to Augustus Caesar. At the same time, I find in a country this large, this diverse, with the mass media under control of corporate conglomerates, and uh, uh, with with a deeply conservative bent and whose primary interest is in advertising revenue, it's very hard to imagine this actually occurring. The possibility of a military takeover, well, General Tommy Franks, the commander in the assault on Baghdad, has already warned that in case of another attack like 9/11, he believes a military takeover would be inevitable. I'm not sure that that's true. I argue this in some length in Nemesis. One of the chief constraints today, I think, is that as a result of the tortures at Abu Ghraib, the only people prosecuted and imprisoned have been extremely low-level enlisted men. This has had the effect within the armed forces of spreading the word that in the case of illegal orders, if you follow them, you may go to prison over it. The officers will be exempt and will be freed. The result is that there's a very real sense in the armed forces of whether an order might or might not be illegal. There couldn't be a more illegal order than to take over Congress, for example. And I think the officer corps is not at all sure that the rank and file would obey them in an attempt to take over today. But those are things that we would have to wait and see. I believe that what will happen to the country is that we will stagger along under a pretense and facade of constitutional government until we are overtaken by bankruptcy.
Now, there is a division, though, within the establishment. And since Bush launched the war in Iraq, between him and his cohorts, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, and the neocons,
right,
and the old line establishment represented, let's say, his father, James Baker, Brent Scowcroft, and so on, and others who seem to think that or the present administration is in the process of destroying the country and damaging its global position.
Yes.
And they were opposed to the invasion and overthrow of Saddam, and most definitely are opposed to the possibility of an attack on Iran. But back in power, would they be any less keynesian than the present administration?
I'm not at all certain that would make any difference.
Yeah.
Exactly is what you're saying. That is to say, they're not going to reverse our commitment to militarism. They're not going to try and put checks on the military-industrial complex. It is extremely doubtful that they actually would try to restore congressional oversight of the executive branch, that is, the operating branch of the government. And so that, indeed, all of this talk about traditional realism a la Henry Kissinger versus neoconservatism seems to be a somewhat false issue, living in a fool's paradise in which one doesn't really realize what could happen to the country. I mean, if you and I were having this conversation in, say, 1985, and I had said to you that 5 years from now the Soviet Union will no longer exist, you would have thought this is not actually a very reliable commentator. Seemed almost inconceivable that one of the two superpowers would simply disappear. Well, it did. Russia today is a considerably smaller place than the former USSR was. It came apart very rapidly, largely because of the same kind of pressures on us: imperial overstretch, intense ideology, inability to reform. And it was always poorer than we are, and that they therefore went first. All I'm really trying to say here is that the collapse of empires is not something particularly novel. We've seen in the 20th century the collapse of the Nazi, Imperial Japanese, British, French, Dutch, Soviet empires, all of which went quite rapidly. We have the highest trade deficits, that is, as a component of the current account deficit, in recorded economic history. As a percentage of gross domestic product, it's up so high that if you were a student of economics at any American university, you'd be told that that's not something that can be sustained. We continue to just lavish money on so-called defense projects like, anti-satellite weapons in outer space or anti-ballistic missile devices that don't work, that are the only thing about them that they, as you can say, is they are unimaginably expensive, and that's what the military-industrial complex is working for. They don't care whether it works. It keeps them in business. But as Herb Stein, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers in a Republican administration years ago once said, things that can't go on forever don't. We then could look around at some other examples. Bankruptcy is not an unknown phenomenon for a country. Germany in 1923, China in 1948, Argentina just in 2001 and 2. That is, the richest country in South America turned into a basket case as a result of this kind of failure. And yet we continue to go on and on and on. It's a little bit like global warming, the refusal to acknowledge that we have a very serious problem with greenhouse gases. But the United States still has the legacy of democracy. The public still thinks about it in emotional terms. What we've been talking about is the degree to which, if the price of liberty is eternal vigilance, the Americans have not been particularly vigilant throughout the Cold War and are now paying the costs enormously. It is, in my opinion, out of control. But I wouldn't say that it was a totalitarian system in the sense of either Stalin's Russia or Hitler's Germany. That is, of a single overarching ideology. There are some hints of that in the radical Christian right in America, demanding a sort of unquestioned, unthinking loyalty to their positions. And there are certainly hidden structures in the United States that positively appear totalitarian. But totalitarianism, as described, as understood by Arendt, for example, in her great book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, is not, I think, a feature of the United States yet. I grant you, any student in Econ 101 in any American university would by now have said, look, the American dollar has got to collapse. It's gone too far. Standard economic theory tells us that when you get as distorted a relationship with the rest of the world as the United States has today, the dollar should collapse. You should not be able to buy foreign products. Oil would go off the charts. The question is why this hasn't happened. Well, the chief reason is that two extremely rich countries today, China and Japan, continue to finance America's profligate living off of the tab for purposes of their own domestic policies. Namely, they want to maintain full employment and continue to sell products to the Americans. This is slowly but almost inevitably changing the balance of power in favor of China and keeping Japan as the world's as a powerhouse of manufacturing. The day that the Minister of Finance of China decides that he doesn't want to continue to hold almost $1 trillion worth of U.S. dollars, which is an unimaginable sum. That's $1,000 billion. The game is over. The American stock market collapses. We turn into Argentina overnight. We have to get used to being a poor country. Some economists are calling a Blanche Dubois economy, an economy that depends upon the kindness of others. There aren't too many people who want to be kind to the United States today, and it would change our influence on international affairs instantly and overnight. When that happens, we don't know. No one can predict it. Every time there's even the slightest shiver of something like that happened, the Ministry of Finance of the Republic of Korea earlier in 2006 said that it's holding too many dollars. The effect was just instantaneous around the world as bankers tried to talk the Koreans out of it, blah, 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 and they did. They did talk them out of it. They decided to. And there's no doubt that countries like China are today privately, without an announcement, moving money into euros or yen just as carefully as they can without causing a panic and the collapse of the dollar. But this is the structural precipice on which we rest, and why I say even if we avoid a military takeover or other kinds of catastrophes that could occur, I fear that bankruptcy is in our future.
Chalmers Johnson, interviewed by Jeff Blankfort, host of Takes on the World, heard on KZYX in Mendocino, California. Thanks to Jeff and to Mariah Gallardon for making that available to us. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
Come get out of the way, boys. Quick, get out of the way. You'd better watch what you say, boys. Better watch what you say. We've rammed in your harbor and tied to your port, and our pistols are hungry and our tempers are short. So bring your daughters around to the fore, 'cause we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world.
The stock market hit record highs this week, which CNN Online attributed to, quote, the alleviation of some concerns about the health of the economy following the Federal Reserve's decision and statement Wednesday and some of the economic news Thursday, close quote. But the report continued with this statement. Thursday's reports included a mild read on a relevant inflation indicator and a big drop in jobless claims ahead of Friday's monthly jobs report. On the downside, another report showed contraction in the manufacturing sector. Close quote. Capitalism grew up with the Industrial Revolution and is based on the sale above cost of products created through the transformation of natural resources by human labor. Continued profitability relies on growth. More buyers for more products. Not only has this led to ecological catastrophe, but it is, according to our next speaker, failing on its own terms. And the economic bubbles, the quest for new areas of life to privatize, and the dizzying speed of mergers show desperate attempts to deal with what is actually declining profitability. UCLA economic historian Robert Brenner is the author of The Economics of Global Turbulence, The Advanced Capitalist Economies from Long Boom to Long Downturn, 1945 to 2005. Next, we're going to hear a presentation he gave to academic colleagues on his research that studies the hard numbers below the babble and the bubbles. This is a dense and demanding talk, especially for non-economists, because it assumes some understanding of economic terms and principles. You may wish to hear it several times, as I did, and you'll be able to download this show from the archives at unwelcomeguest.org right after the program. This is show number 344. Here's Professor Robert Brenner.
All right, so what I'd like to do in this talk is offer an account of where the U.S. and world economy is at today and where it's going. To do this, I want to look at the current period from three temporal perspectives, focusing in ever more closely on the present, first from a long-run perspective, then a medium-run perspective, finally a short-run perspective. Now, the long run here, for me, encompasses the whole of the post-war epoch, from the end of the 1940s into the present, and especially for present purposes, the long period of economic slowdown for most of the capitalist world that began in 1973. Second, the medium-term perspective takes as its point of departure the early 1980s, kind of a turning point in the world economy, the point at which the world economy began its shift toward neoliberalism. And at the same time, the U.S. economy initiated what turned out to be a very major, but ultimately abortive economic recovery between the years 85 and 95. So medium term, I'm going to focus on rise of neoliberalism, free market, all that, and at the same time, striking American recovery in the context of stagnation, which, however, failed ultimately to bear fruit. Finally, the short-run perspective, from the standpoint of economics, it's rather a long-run perspective, but for starring, it's nothing, from 1995 to the present, a period of ongoing bubble economy, run-ups of asset prices, featuring first the stock market bubble in the second half of the 90s, and then the housing price bubble of the last 5 years or so, which I'm sure all of you have participated in. So, to begin with, it's about this long-run business. The post-war economy naturally divides itself into two parts. You just have to look at the numbers, and you don't even have to have a theory, because there's such a sharp break, and before and after are so different. Running from the end of the 1940s to 1973, the long boom, and then a long downturn from 1973 actually to the present. For at least the last decade or so, since the time of the new economy, people remember that one, the financial press and the politicians have been assuring us that we're at the end of stagnation and on the verge of a great new boom. But the facts of the matter are really quite different. Not only has the long downturn persisted right into the present, but for the advanced capitalist economies, the most powerful ones, there's been a more or less continuous worsening of economic performance in terms of virtually all the standard economic indicators, business cycle by is business cycle. In fact, during the last 5 years, for the new business cycle that began in February 2001, the performance of the U.S. economy and the advanced capitalist economies more generally have been the worst for any comparable five-year period since 1950, except the handful of years around the Great Recession of 1974-5. So just about the worst period of the post-war period we've been in this last period of expansion. If you take a look at the first table there, it lays out the, as it were, the facts of that long downturn and long, not just downturn, but slow down. So declining economic dynamism. Now, what accounts for this pattern of economic performance? To me, the key is the pattern of profitability, the profit rate. For the period from the end of the 40s to the later 1960s, you have persistently high profitability. And if I had had the brains to do it, I would have, might be here somewhere. Yeah, table 15.1. You can see the average rates of profit, 49, 59, 60, 69. They basically stay high and stay the same. So essentially, for the long boom, you have persistently high profit rates. And you can also see it in the figure 15.6, figure 0.4. But then, from the mid-1960s, there's a major fall in the rate of profit. And perhaps most important for present purposes, there's no recovery of profitability right through to the end of the century. So it's my general proposition that persistently high profit rates accounted for the long post-war boom, and persistently low profit rates accounted for the long downturn extending right into the present. So those next three tables and graphs, you can see that point. Now, the underlying theory behind that proposition, that profitability is the key to economic dynamism, is pretty straightforward. First, the rate of profit is a rough and ready determinant of the surpluses that firms have at their disposal to invest. In addition, the realized rates of profit, that is the rates of profit people got in the past, for most firms, is the best predictor they have of prospective profits, that is, the future profits they can hope for. So when profitability is high, you get high investment, that is, high growth of the capital stock and also high growth of employment. When profitability is low, you get the reverse, the slow growth of investment and of employment. So if we apply those simple generalizations about profitability and capital accumulation to the post-war period as a whole, we get an initial understanding of the pattern of economic development. Between 48 and the late 60s, profitability remained high and made for the long boom. Between 1965 and 1973, if you look at those graphs, profit rate fell sharply and continued to do so to the end of the 70s. So profitability fell between 65 and 73 and further between 73 and 79 and never did recover. The result was that the growth of investment or the capital stock fell, growth of employment fell. Because the growth of the capital stock, you know, that means the amount of plant and equipment per person, grew more slowly, workers had less to work with, in dynamic terms, productivity growth declined. because not only productivity growth, but also the increase of employment slowed down. That is the demand for labor. So did real wages. So from this standpoint, profitability is very powerful, if you accept this, in giving you a mechanism that drives economic growth, or doesn't. And you can look at the same progression from the standpoint of demand, or aggregate demand, which is what directly drives the economy. Because the rate of profit fell, firms had smaller surpluses, so they cut back on investment, capital accumulation, with the result that the growth of investment demand, meaning the demand for new plant and equipment, fell. Because the profit rate fell, firms reduced the growth of employment and the growth of wages, with the result that the growth of consumer demand fell. And because governments sought to help capital to improve the conditions for profitability, they reduced the growth of government spending, especially on social services, so the growth of government demand fell. So because the growth of investment demand plus consumer demand plus government demand fell and continued to do so, we got economic stagnation, indeed that worsening economic stagnation that I was talking about. In sum, the bottom line is that the fall in the rate of profit and the failure of the rate of profit to recover has made for long-term decline and stagnation of aggregate demand, and this is made for the extension of the long downturn. Again, economic performance has gotten worse, business cycle by business cycle since 1973. And the most recent business cycle, the one that began in February 2001, continues into the present, has been the worst of all. So these progressions you can follow when you're so inclined in these two sets of tables starting 15.1 through 15.6. Basically, that lays out these progressions I just spoke about from the rate of profit through capital and employment growth and so forth. So, well, if the decline and especially the failure of recovery of the rate of profit is behind the long period of slowed growth, the fundamental question obviously becomes what was responsible for the trajectory of the profit rate. And this is, of course, a huge theoretical and historical question, really too big to fully confront here. So I have to content myself with a very schematic outline that kind of combines the theory and the history in a fairly truncated way, but you get the basic idea. And in question period, you could challenge me and raise questions about this. Anyway, the basic idea is that the great post-war boom in the advanced capitalist countries should be understood in terms of this sort of a reflection of or expression of a process of uneven development, which was driven by the interaction between an earlier developing, socially and technologically advanced, and hegemonic block of capital focused in the United States, and a later developing, socio-technologically relatively backward, and hegemonized blocks of capital in Western Europe and Japan. The later developing blocks derived their huge, really historically unprecedented economic dynamism from their highly organized capitalisms, the high levels of intervention by their states and their economies, the cheap factors of production, especially cheap labor relative to the United States, and finally, their ability to catch up, to borrow technology and catch up with the U.S. This allowed them to grow with historically unprecedented rapidity, especially by depending on manufacturing exports. Manufacturing was the core of their, sort of the motor of their growth. Trade, manufacturing exports was particularly where they got that extra fillip for their growth. U.S. earlier developing bloc, by contrast, derived its dynamism from its technological leadership, and in particular from the foreign direct investment of its multinational corporations, and the overseas expansion of its international banks, as well as the initial strength of its great manufacturers. In other words, and this might be something people will want to talk about, U.S. expansion in the 50s and 60s entailed the first phase of that process of globalization that has continued today. Globalization began then, and really under the auspices of the United States, and particularly of the leadership of American, what became at this time multinationals and international financiers. Now, at first, the interaction between the American economy on the one hand and the Japanese and West European economies on the other was highly symbiotic. that is mutually supportive. And this gave rise to the historically unprecedented economic dynamism of the post-war boom. Japan, Germany, and Western Europe expanded rapidly, especially by means of seizing huge chunks. Actually, they ripped off huge chunks of the world market from the United States and the United Kingdom. But U.S. companies also did well. U.S. multinational corporations and banks invaded Europe, while U.S. domestic manufacturers were able to prosper by continuing to dominate the huge U.S. market. So the Europeans essentially had the European and Japanese markets and essentially appropriating the huge part of the world market that the U.S. inherited after 1945 when it emerged as, you know, kind of unquestionably dominant. But American capital prospered by invading Europe on the one hand and by holding control of this great American market. So, great post-war boom. Nevertheless, after a point, and this is kind of the way one tries to make an account of change and move from boom to crisis by saying that essentially the same sort of process, the same sort of mechanism extended past a certain point moves from having a positive to a negative characteristic. So after a certain point, what had been symbiosis dissolves into conflict, basically a heightening struggle for shares of the world market. So from the mid-1960s, what we see is a marked intensification of international competition, which led in turn to the rise of overcapacity in the international manufacturing sector. As a result of that overcapacity, firms across the world market found they could no longer mark up or raise prices above cost of production sufficiently to bring their profits and manufacturing, to sustain their profits. And manufacturing profit rates fell sharply between 65 and 73, bringing down profit rates for the private sectors of the capitalist economies taken together. Manufacturing profit rates for the advanced capitalist economies taken in aggregate fell further between 73 and 79 and have not recovered since. Now, obviously, you want to have some evidence of, well, how can you say that that is the case? Well, it would take some time to discuss it, but if you look at figure 8.1, this is sort of a exhibit A in trying to make a case that it's, what's the problem is manufacturing overcapacity. And what this basically shows is that the fall in profitability takes place almost 100% in the manufacturing sector. If you disaggregate the economy, you look at manufacturing and non-manufacturing, non-manufacturing barely changes, barely falls. In fact, the whole period, relatively stable. All the action is in manufacturing. And so what's being said here is that it's the pressure on prices that comes from the exposure of this manufacturing sector to the world market, by contrast to the non-manufacturing sector, not exposed to the world market, that brings down that rate of profit. So if you look further, what you'd see is that the costs, the paradox here, is that the costs in manufacturing over this period of declining rate of profit actually grow quite a bit more slowly than in non-manufacturing, therefore putting less pressure in cost terms, or so to speak, from below on the rate of profit. But the problem they face is that the prices that the manufacturers can charge raises relatively much more slowly than in non-manufacturing. And it's that difference, the ability to raise prices or not, that accounts for the divergence of manufacturing and non-manufacturing sector, and accounts, in fact, for the fall of the rate of profit in the manufacturing sector, and by extension, in the private economy as a whole. Okay, but if the initial fall in the rate of profit resulted from the onset of overcapacity in the advanced capitalist economies, this poses a huge problem, because by then, given that the rate of profit is being driven down by too much supply vis-a-vis demand in manufacturing, how come it stays down for so long? Why has it not recovered? Why was there, in other words, in sort of garden variety economic terms, no adjustment? This problem of the persistence of reduced profitability imposed itself with special force, because from the time of the fall in the rate of profit between 1965 and 1973, We know that firms and governments devoted themselves with ever greater determination and self-consciousness to implementing measures with the specific purpose of bringing the rate of profit back up by attempting to reduce costs and transforming their ways of doing business and by changing the nature of state regulation of the economy. They unleashed an ever broader assault on the working class by reducing the growth and sometimes the absolute levels of wages and social services while assaulting the basic organizations of workers' defense, the unions. They sought to neoliberalize the economy by deregulating labor and commodity markets, privatizing state enterprises, freeing up the formerly repressed financial sector previously been tightly controlled in most of the world by the governments, most of the advanced capitalist world. They shifted capital out of high-cost, low-profit manufacturing lines, especially into financial services. They forced open markets for commodities, foreign direct investment, financial services, and short-term capital throughout the less developed countries. They stepped up foreign direct investment for the purpose of relocating manufacturing in selected regions of what had been called the Third World in order to combine low-cost but increasingly skilled and well-educated labor with the best possible technique, creating in the process complex networks of production or production chains. They in turn turned increasingly to speculation in ever more sophisticated forms, and they sought profits throughout much of the global South by means of the rapid inflow and outflow of hot money to and from newly freed markets and financial assets. In fact, all of the foregoing interrelated processes, which we know as neoliberal globalization, constituted, in my view, nothing more nor less than an ever more systemic problem of reduced profit rates. But the overriding fact remains that although these measures were pursued ever more vigorously during the 80s and 90s, taken together, they failed to prevent the economy's performance from worsening as time went on. And the bottom line, they failed to restore the rate of profit. And if you look at, you know, there's a variety of indicators here on in table declining profitability and its consequences, table 15. They do because the foreign earned profits fall within the European rates of profit. In other words, the American profit rates are domestic only. But the American foreign investment, their profit rates would happen, say, fit within the German economy or within the French economy or so on. This is the way the national accounts work. So that's the way, you know. So it's an interesting question. Alan is raising... Yeah. Clearly, Alan's raising the question, well, you have this data about national profit rates comes from the national accounts of the United States. What about, and indicating the corporations are in some having some problem, what about their profits from foreign investment, and how do you take that into account? And what I said was, what I'm trying to argue for is basically the question of the system-wide problem of profitability. So I'm saying, well, if they do have higher rates of profit, say, on their overseas investment, these higher profit rates will be registered in the profit rates of Germany or France or wherever that is, and yet in aggregate, the world advanced capitalist profit rates did not recover.